Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymeer Church of Christ.
Today has truly been a blessing, and we look forward to the continued blessing of worshiping together. Thank you for having Dale Manor. We're thankful for having Dale Manor with us. We were able to, over our lunch break and time visiting together, to find all kinds of Columbia connections. I know we have several here who are Harding alumni, and then others who have children at Harding, and it's just amazing all of the connections that are there. He's also going to be staying with us tonight and be working tomorrow with our preaching workshop, so we're really putting him to work once we got him here. But we'll have about 50 individuals in ministry, elders and Bible teachers from Arkansas and Alabama and Kentucky and Tennessee that'll spend the day tomorrow looking at what we can learn about preaching from the life of David. And so we're really excited about that. On behalf of those who participate in it, I want to thank you for being a congregation that will encourage those sorts of opportunities. Every year, some of the people who come there will tell me, "This is so great. Be sure to thank Graymeer." And so I want to do that every chance I have the opportunity. But we're looking forward to that. That's going to be a wonderful time together. And we're looking forward to what we'll be thinking about this afternoon. This is one of those sessions that as we were planning sort of what the day would be about and among the ministers, this was an area, when we think about afterlife in the Old Testament, that I think will be a good one for us, a fascinating study, and we'll look forward to what we can glean from that. And so without taking up any more of your time, ask Brother Manor to come and share the word with us.
I want to thank you all for the kind responses and comments that you have made about the reception thus far. I forgotten your name. Andrew. I'm still on drugs. Okay. And I need to take another one because my head's really getting stopped. I'm sorry, Andrew. Anyway, I told him yesterday I may not be on my A game, and there was proof of it pretty badly right now. But the topic under consideration here is one that is probably the most technical of the discussions, certainly of these three. And for some of you, this is almost a non-issue. I mean, for all of us, to a large extent, it's a non-issue. But on a certain level, the Old Testament does not talk a whole lot about the Old Testament. But one of the problems that arises in the academic world, and inevitably what happens in the academic world, often has a tendency to trickle down into congregational settings. May not always be within the churches of Christ. Although, if you have young people that go to a state university, and one of the tendencies many times is for those who go to state universities from the church, is they'll take a Bible class because they think, "I know the Bible, therefore this is going to be a snap course." And then they get stuck in that, and usually in a class where the professor has no respect for the Bible and as a document of validity and credibility and faith, and will attempt to undermine it and argue that it is irrelevant. And often the student then is bewildered. But one of the topics that will sometimes come up has to do with the idea of afterlife in the Old Testament, and the argument that the Old Testament people had no understanding of an afterlife. And this is sort of what began this discussion as we're going to look at this. Now, the first part of this is a survey of a number of textual passages. So next slide, please. Now, it's John in the book, and we're going to come at this in reverse. Now, I realize that's not always the best way to do this, but I want to set the scene. Let's look at what does the New Testament say and imply about what is going on in the Old Testament. And I realize for some people this is not a legitimate approach, but I think for those of us who are believers, certainly it is legitimate. John sees in his vision, and I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000 sealed out of every tribe of the sons of Israel. Next. And then he says, the holy city, of the holy city, that it had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, And on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. Now in both of these passages you certainly have references to, in a New Testament context, this comprehensiveness of this children of Israel being involved in the framework of this perspective of heaven. Next. Jesus, in similar fashion, will talk with those who are listening to him. Next slide. I tell you, many will come from east and west and sit at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Now, next point is going to emphasize that the implications of this, that the event about which Jesus is speaking is obviously something that is yet to occur. It's a future event. And Jesus talks about this is going to occur when people will gather. And many will be gathered with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in that altogether context at a future point. Implicit in this is the idea that these people of the Old Testament time period are somewhere for them to be reunited in that fashion. John's and Jesus' statements both indicate that the righteous of both the Old and New Testament eras will share eternal life. And so then the lurking question is, so where are those in the Old Testament period who had already passed? There must be some sort of an afterlife that they are experiencing in some fashion. Next slide. Did the people of the Old Testament have any understanding of an afterlife? And I'm going to submit to you that they did. And I'm going to also then demonstrate, I think rather tellingly, that the Israelites didn't have unique understanding on this. I mean, they had some unique perspectives, but they were not alone in their understanding of an afterlife. And then many scholars, and this is where the problem erupts, many scholars and the popular press following their lead, how many times do we hear popular press issues these days? But many scholars argue that the ideas of the afterlife and the judgment only came late in the Old Testament era. And by that I mean exilic and post-exilic. Next. It is popular for many to argue that the Hebrews basically made no significant contributions to religion, but that they borrowed everything. Hence the Bible did not come from God. And this is the slate that often our young people will hear in state universities and in many of the skeptical, even religious seminaries. They would argue that the creation account is appropriated by the Bible from Mesopotamian origins. And they'll often cite the Epic of Gilgamesh, Enuma Elish, and other sources. They'll argue that the flood epic comes from Mesopotamia. They'll argue that the Mosaic Law is from Mesopotamia, pointing to the Code of Hammurabi as a document that predates the Mosaic Law. They would argue that even monotheism is an adaptation from the Egyptians, when Akhenaten, they would argue, is the first one who was a monotheist, which I would submit is not necessarily true. Modern mainline scholarship argues that the Old Testament is a late production, and that by that they mean it was produced during the exile and after. Now, there's no question that as we look at the pages of the Old Testament, there are parts of it that are of late production. The books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther obviously are post-exilic. They were not written before the exile. And there are certain elements in which it's fairly clear that even the historical books came together in the fashion that we have them at a point that is late. But that is not to argue that they are not historical. Modern scholarship typically argues that the Hebrew ideas of the afterlife came from Israel's contacts with Zoroastrianism while they were in exile. And hence, the argument is, they had no understanding of an afterlife before they went into exile. And I want to submit to you, that is a false reading of the text. Next. This, of course, assumes that all Scripture is late production, which I don't buy into at all. And it fails to recognize the progressive nature of revelation. Now, the next slide will point out a premise of what we traditionally have understood from starlight to sunlight imagery. Now, the imagery here is that in the beginning of the revelation of God, and to a certain extent this makes perfectly good sense, that God does not divulge everything that he's going to do from the very beginning. He keeps his agenda hidden, if you will, at least hidden from Satan, to minimize Satan's interference into what God is going to accomplish. But there are these glimpses that appear. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. That is one of those images that is a glimpse of something that is going to happen at a later time. But God does not divulge what all that means when he first reveals it. But as time passes, the issue is that it becomes clearer. Just like walking out on a clear night that is a new moon, the stars are not a very good source of light by which to see where you're going. But if the moon is out, full moon, then you can see quite clearly. But then that's nowhere near as clear as when the sun is shining. So you have this progressive kind of revelation that characterizes God's will. The Bible will affirm similar passages and concepts. As the Hebrew writer affirms, in the past God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, in contrast to those partial elements, in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. And Peter will point out the same kind of point that even the angels desired to see the revelation, understand what God was doing, but they could not do so until Jesus made it clear. And this is part of the underlying element in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 11 through 12. Even the heavenly beings didn't always know what all was going on. The Father and the Son did, but the angels were kept, apparently, in the dark about some of the aspects that are involved. Now, if they were kept in the dark, why should we assume that we should be the ones to receive the full revelation at a point prior to them? Okay, next. Now, I want to look at this from an archaeological standpoint. And I think from an archaeological standpoint, the argument that the children of Israel did not have an understanding of the afterlife until Zoroastrianism makes absolutely no sense. The picture you're looking at is certainly one that every elementary age child is familiar with, at least beginning in second or third grade or so. I expect every second or third or fourth grader could explain what those pictures are. And at the pyramid there was a tomb designed to house the body of the deceased king in the afterlife. Well, that's exactly the point. In 2500 B.C., next slide, you have the tomb at the Great Pyramid with its inner chamber. Next, you have the inner chamber that was originally constructed, and then the queen's chamber, and then the king's chamber at the higher elevation as time passed and the pyramid took shape. Some of us have had the privilege of climbing up into this. It's quite an interesting chore in and of itself. But why did they go to all this trouble? Because they believed in some kind of an afterlife. Another element of Egyptian testimony to this is the ship that was found almost by accident on the south side of the pyramid, the bark that would bear the soul of the king into the afterlife. And it's a lot of discussion about whether there's a second one next to it, but they haven't fully gotten to the point of deciding exactly how to pursue this. But these date from 2500 B.C., long before there was an Israel. Next. We can also consider Tutankhamun's tomb. And all of us are familiar with this. The fantastic discovery made in 1922 as Carter unveils this and began over the span of the next almost 10 years to dismantle and study all of this. And among all of these displays were certainly components that were intended to accompany the king into the afterlife. His chariotry, urns of food, wine, ointments, furnishings, and all kinds of other accompanying elements, along with which were, next slide, over 400 ushabtis, which were to be animated in the afterlife to serve as servants of the king. I mean, this was their understanding. That's what an ushabti was within the framework of Egyptian burial practices. So again, from the time that the children of Israel, about the time they're leaving the land of Egypt, the Egyptians certainly have a well-developed perspective of an afterlife. But that afterlife has some moral responsibilities as well. The next picture is a drawing of what is known as the weighing of the heart ceremony. And as we look at this, this actually should be divided into three registers. And I'm going to have to come down to point out some of the aspects here. So it's divided into these three registers where you have the one on the far left, and then the middle one, and then the far right one. And it's sort of like, felt like I was tripping over a string or something. It's sort of like looking at a cartoon register, although this is obviously not a cartoon, all right? But it's these registers without the dividing line. So I've presented the dividing lines to show you sort of the pictures that are involved. And what has happened is the deceased here is being ushered by Anubis into the afterlife. Anubis is the one who protects the deceased in the afterlife, the dog that is out there in the tomb areas. And he is ushering him into the afterlife. And this is the critical component I want us to notice. Now, this is a date. The date of this drawing is about 1150 B.C. But all scholars that I'm aware of would argue this actually reflects a long-standing of hundreds of years tradition of the understanding of the weighing of the heart ceremony. And the critical component is here, where Anubis is sitting there, and you see the scales with the bar that is there and the scale on each side. And on one side is the heart of the deceased, and the other side is a feather. Now, if you've ever thought in terms of weighing a feather and a heart with one another, the heart would inevitably be much heavier than the feather. But the issue here is this is a weighing of the purity of the heart, the ma'at of the individual, if you will. And this critter that is sitting here is anxiously awaiting the outcome of the declaration. Thoth is the record keeper, and he is keeping record of what all has happened. And whenever the verdict is given, if the person finds that his heart is heavier than the feather, that dude gets to devour him. That's why he looks so anxious, you know, gets to pounce on have a meal. On the other hand, if the feather is heavier than the heart, then he didn't get to eat anything. And in this case, if you look very carefully, the feather is heavier than the heart, so the deceased is going to be ushered by Horus into the afterlife, into the presence of Osiris. Now, that's a rather sophisticated drawing of a judgment scene. So not only did they believe in the afterlife, they believed in a judgment that is part of going into the afterlife. I think, you know, to argue that the children of Israel didn't get any idea of an afterlife until they went into exile, 700-800 years later, is pretty absurd kind of premise. But we move on. Next slide. We go to Mesopotamia. We pick up the same kind of approximate scene. This is the royal tombs at Ur, dating from about 2500 B.C. And this is a drawing of Sir Leonard Woolley's excavation at some of those tombs. And all of these circles, this is the royal burial chamber in which the individual was interred. But all of these round figures that you see here are the skulls of individuals that were put to death or voluntarily took their own lives to accompany the deceased into the afterlife. Now that implies their belief in there being an afterlife in order to, one, need assistance and attendance and so forth. Now whether the victims that die here are willing victims or not, I'm not going to go there, but nonetheless, some of them probably were. Then you have the wagons and the oxen that are slain as well. And all of this is a portrayal of that kind of perception of an afterlife that it requires, I put that in quotes, requires some sort of attendant to care for them and assist them. The next picture will show some of the grave goods associated with this. You have part of the lyre that is there, a game board, and drinking vessels. Next picture. Here is some artistry that is there, headbands, a musical instrument, a dagger, and so forth. And these are all wealthy items that are taken out of use. Now, I suspect that the individuals, if they ever broke into one of these tombs, realized that these things are still there. But nonetheless, they thought in terms of there being the necessity of its representation for the reality to exist in the afterlife. But nonetheless, the afterlife is an extremely important concept. Next picture. As we move to the area of the Canaanite world, particularly Ugarit, one of the excavation procedures at the site of Ugarit, this, by the way, is the site I was alluding to this morning when I talked about the Syrian peasant's plow getting caught on a rock. It was the discovery of all of this and all the huge library of literature that came and accompanied with that. But in this, the tombs were often dug beneath the houses with a tube going down from the kitchen to feed the deceased from time to time. Which is sort of bizarre, but on another level, it's understandable. If you have to eat in this life, in some sense, you need to eat in the next. And of course, Tutankhamun's tomb implies that with the foodstuffs that were buried with him and other kinds of scenarios that we find as well. Now, I'm not going to argue their understanding of the afterlife was always on target, but nonetheless, they had an understanding of the afterlife. Now, next slide. Now, we come back to some discussions within the text itself. What hints does the Bible give of an understanding of an afterlife in the Old Testament? Well, we can begin with a discussion of the Pentateuch. Now, I'm going to come at this again in reverse. Jesus has this discussion with the Sadducees. And, of course, the Bible points out that the Sadducees do not believe in the resurrection, so they're going to try to make the resurrection look like a silly concept. And so they're asking about the resurrection and this scenario of this man married to a woman and he dies and they have no children, so the brother of the deceased marries her according to Levirate law to raise up children in the name of the deceased. He dies and there are no children. There are seven brothers. All of them marry the woman. No children result from this. But in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? On a certain level, that makes perfectly good sense to ask the question. On the assumption that there is marriage in heaven. Of course, that's part of what Jesus responds to. But the telling issue as far as this discussion is concerned is how Jesus zeroes in on Exodus chapter 3, verse 6 as evidence of a proof of a resurrection. When he argues that, have you not read in the Scriptures where God says at the place of the burning of the bush, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. Now the argument in a sense hinges upon that present tense verb. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jesus, of course, God in this scenario is talking to Moses years after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have died. How can he still be their God if they're not alive somewhere? And that's the point that Jesus is getting at. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. Now, that should have been enough to the Sadducees to prove that there was a resurrection, at least from the standpoint of Scripture. But they're not going to buy it. But as we proceed in the discussion, next, you have the episode of Isaac's sacrifice, Genesis chapter 22. I can only infer how traumatic this must have been, not only for Isaac potentially, but also for Abraham. Abraham had been told that through Isaac, the fulfillment of all these promises was going to take place. And God comes along and says, I want you to take your son and sacrifice him on the Mount Moriah. That makes no sense. But Abraham was an individual of significant faith, profound faith, to the point that when he's asked about where is the lamb for the sacrifice, he responds rather cryptically to Isaac, God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering. But that the Hebrew writer will emphasize that Abraham understood that God was able to raise the dead. Maybe that was what salved his conscience to go ahead and potentially kill his son, realizing that God could raise the dead. I think this is a rather telling example of at least the concept of a resurrection and an afterlife within the pages of the Old Testament. Next. Or we can turn to the historical books and look at some hints that are found within that. Next, the death of David's son, one of those telling episodes of the episode with David and Bathsheba. As punishment for the sin, God decrees that the child of that union is not going to live. And David then, the child is born, and David is moping around the house and the palace, mournful, just disheveled, and everything is going badly, and finally this child dies, and the servants are afraid to let David know that he's passed away because they're not sure what David will do, because things have gone so poorly as far as their perception of David is concerned. And David sees them talking amongst themselves, and he asks, has the child passed? And they said, yes, he has. And David says, alright, let me go clean myself up and bring me some food. And the servants then are bewildered. Wonder, you were all in all this kind of moaning and mourning and everything else beforehand, but now when the child is dead, you're asking for everything to be straightened out. And his response is telling. While a child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me, that the child may live. But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. At a certain level, as you think about what this says, does this sound like David is finding comfort by simply saying, well, I'm going to die too? I mean, that's not an element of comfort in how he phrases this. The phrase is that he's looking forward, since God did not allow the son to come back to me now and he survived this illness, I at least will be with him in the afterlife. And this doesn't sound like, well, I'm going to be stuck in the ground with him too. I mean, it sounds much more comforting than simply that. Or we look at another passage. Elijah raises a young boy from the dead. Certainly the Bible talks implicit within an afterlife, this soul coming back to this body. Or another, Elisha raises a young boy in 2 Kings chapter 4. Or the bizarre episode where a post-mortem Elisha, this is the occasion when a servant is thrown into the tomb of Elisha and touches the bones of Elisha and he then pops back to life. I mean, this is a weird story. But nonetheless, each of these episodes are the reuniting of the soul of an individual to the body that individual possessed. Well, if that's not implicit that there's some kind of an afterlife, to have a soul reunited, I don't know what it implies. It's not the recreation of a soul. It's the person coming back to life. Or we look at some other passages. Next. Some of those in the poetic books. Now, the poetic books are, in a sense, are a little more cryptic. But this one is fairly well known. We occasionally sing about this. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then either in my flesh I shall see God. And there is a problem with the Hebrew here, how exactly to translate it. So some versions will say, then apart from my flesh I shall see God. But regardless of whether it's in my flesh or apart from my flesh, he's going to see God once this life is over. There's an afterlife implicit in these words of comfort. I know that my Redeemer lives. And we occasionally sing the song affirming exactly that premise as we talk about, I know that my Redeemer lives and ever prays for me. I mean, we know the song and we sing it with vigor and with confidence. And this is exactly from where that comes. Next. In Hosea chapter 13, Hosea, coming toward the end of his discussion, shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol, which is the Hebrew word here referring to the grave? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your plagues? O Sheol, where is your destruction? Compassion is hidden from my eyes. Now, if you're really right on top of the game, you realize that this is a passage that Paul will quote in 1 Corinthians 15, talking about the power of the resurrection over death. And the afterlife that we have, that we need not fear death because there is a life yet to come. Next. Now, there are some Old Testament phrases that then take on some particularly interesting dynamic. Now, you're going to think I'm really bizarre because I've talked about the burial practices of the time of Jesus. We're going to talk about burial practices of the Old Testament here. I'm not so macabre, but I want you to be aware of how this is working. One of those phrases, and some translations will change this, but one of those phrases, he was gathered to his people. My parents passed away, both of them, over the past 5 years. Mother 5 years ago and dad 2 years ago. And one of the things that they were very concerned about was to be buried in the family plot back in Dunlap, Tennessee. And of course, John and I wanted to honor that, and we took the time to take them over and give them their presence in the family burial plot in Dunlap. Gathered to one's people. Now, a lot of people, this is something that's very important to them, to be buried in the family burial plot, to be reunited in some fashion. Well, in the biblical world, there was far more literality to that than we think in terms of in our world today. Is this just a reference to the burial family plot? That's a fair question. I'm going to suggest that it, in a sense, was. Or does it entail more? And I think it entails more. It entails a perspective that somehow they're going to be together in the afterlife. Not just in the family burial plot, but in some fashion a reuniting. Or we have another phrase. He slept with his fathers. Sadly, this is a phrase that gets a snicker with a lot of young people these days. But this is the biblical phrase as how it's describing it. And numerous passages that could be cited where this occurs in the Hebrew text. Now, as we think in terms of this, next we pose, does this sleeping denote simply the concept of temporaneity? Well, obviously, if someone is asleep, the implication is they're going to wake up. Jesus will use the passage in that fashion when he is told about the death of Lazarus, and Jesus says, I need to go and wake him up. He's asleep. I need to go wake him up. And the disciples, bewildered by this, says, well, if he's asleep, he'll get up on his own. And Jesus has to say, Lazarus is dead. I mean, he's as blunt as he can be in how he explains it. All of us have been to funerals where we have looked at the deceased in the casket and thought about the individual looks so much like him or herself. Looks just like he or she is sleeping. And there's a comfort there. There's a comfort there. Not only from the physical standpoint, but more importantly from the spiritual standpoint. Now, as we look at how this unfolds within the reality of the ancient world, next, we look at some burial practices. This is one from, if you go to the Rockefeller Museum in Israel, just north of the city walls, old city walls, this is a tomb that is reconstructed that was found in Jericho. Dates from the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, I don't know that this is how Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were buried. I'm not going to go that far because we don't know for sure. But I can affirm this. You remember in the biblical narrative in Genesis, the Bible talks about that when Sarah dies, Abraham negotiates with the folks of Hebron at Cave of Machpelah to buy that cave to serve as the tomb for Sarah. Eventually, Abraham is going to be buried in that same tomb. Eventually, then, Isaac and Rebekah are going to be buried in that tomb. And then Jacob and Leah are going to be buried in that tomb. And toward the end of the book of Genesis, Jacob makes a point. You be sure that when I die, you take me back and bury me in the cave where Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Rebekah and Leah are all buried. Rachel, of course, has been buried somewhere else because she died as they were traveling along. But this was the family burial plot, being gathered to one's fathers. Sleeping with the fathers. Part of the family. And in this scenario, what you have is this central platform upon which the deceased would be placed, left to decay. Now, I realize, again, this seems a little macabre, but nonetheless, this is the way it operated. This was important to them. This was something they valued. And then after a period of time, when another individual would pass away, they would go in and they would shovel, if you will, the remains here off to the perimeter. And you can see skulls scattered around the perimeter of others that had been the occupants of that central platform. There are furnishings. These are pieces of wood furnishing. There are various pots scattered around. There's a vessel. Here's a pot that you see in the foreground. A lot of long bones. I don't know if you can see the tall vessel standing up over here, but here's another pot and so forth. Again, the gift offerings, implicit of an understanding of an afterlife. Now, while this is a tomb that would be connected with the Canaanites, it also is probably the kind of thing that characterized Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, you have at least six individuals that are going to be interred in that tomb, and probably more than simply those six. Next slide. Here's a picture, a reconstruction of presenting the different individuals and furnishings and so forth as those would have been portrayed from the artifacts left behind in that tomb. It's a family scene, being gathered to one's fathers. It's a reunion in an afterlife. This is not unique. Next. Now, some burial practices in Jerusalem. This is Judah. This is Israel in the sense that we think in terms of Israel. Some really fascinating ones. Next. This is an interesting tomb. I visited here several times. Actually, twice. Sorry. This is a modern chapel, and you go in, and the width of this room is about maybe 20 feet at most, and about 25 feet long. So it's a pretty good sized room, not massive, but nonetheless pretty accommodating. Then you have these rooms that radiate off in the different directions from the central entrance chamber. Now, if you look at this carefully, you'll notice you walk through here, and this part is level basically with that. So you'd walk through this doorway with a little raised threshold into an area, and these are benches that surround the perimeter. And the benches would be just about the height of this table. So let's assume here's the wall, you walk in here, there would be a bench here, there's a bench here, and there would be a bench here. And each of these benches are designed to accommodate an individual. All right? Now, you'll notice also these little horseshoe things. These are raised stone berms, if you will, around the perimeter here, designed to hold the head of the deceased. Typically, a person who passes away in the ancient world, and even in the modern world, in that part of the world, would be buried the same day he or she passes away. And so they would take the individual and put them on the bench and place the head, cradle the head in that little bermed, raised area to keep the head from flopping over to the side, so keep the head looking straight up. Now, in some of these, you'll have two of them. For instance, there's one there and there's one there. So I'm assuming that somehow they could accommodate two individuals, perhaps simultaneously. Let's assume for the sake of some rules and guidelines, simultaneous. If there's only one horseshoe there, we'll go with that. If there are no horseshoes, headrest, then we'll assume one. So I want to count how many people could be accommodated here. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's a fragment of one there. 12, there's a fragment of one there. Fragment of one, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. So at least 21 individuals could be accommodated here. Now the lurking question is, what happens with number 22? What are you going to do then? Well, this is not the end of the story. Notice the gray areas over here. So let's assume this is my doorway into this little chamber. And you walk in, and on this side, there would be, on the face of that, a hole carved into it with a deposit, with a cave carved beneath it. So after about a year, should they need another one of these platforms? I mean, this is an extended family, okay? So we're looking at 21 people already. So it could be multi-generational. It could be a large extended family. It could be one where certain friends might be accommodated into it, which is the case, would have been the case, apparently, with Jesus being taken in and buried by Joseph of Arimathea. So there'd be other individuals that could be accommodated. But after a period of time, what happens? Well, they'd gather those bones and dump them into cave like that. That actually is in that cave right there, those bones. I remember when I was visiting there and I stuck the camera in here and took the picture and I came back. And, wow, I wasn't expecting that. I just sort of took a picture in the dark with a flash. I'm not trying at all to be disrespectful. To the contrary, we have to understand what they're doing. They're being gathered to one's fathers. Now again, the people in the ancient world understood that these bones are still here, but there's something beyond it. We talk in terms about meta stories today. They understood the metaphysical reality of some kind. That there is something beyond this life that is beyond our corporeal being. And this is the framework within which they're operating. Next. I keep trying to advance it myself. Now, there's another tomb that I want us to consider, and we're getting near the end, by the way. That's a spoiler alert of sorts. You can wake up now. The Kedah Hinnom tomb. Next. The top part of this is missing. It became a rock quarry. They quarried the rocks away. And the lower part of the tomb is all that's left. Next slide will show a reconstruction of that with a cutaway. Here's the opening into the standing area. Notice the little raised berms and so forth. It even shows, in this case, the cave beneath. All right, the next picture shows several of us. I excavated here a number of years ago, and we're sort of showing how the arrangement of the bodies would be. All right, that's me, by the way. So we're laying up here. And the next picture shows, next, there's the cave opening. When this was first excavated back in the late 70s, it's about the only, there were two tombs right next to each other. All the rest of the tombs in the Kedahinnom Valley, at least that have been identified, were plundered, emptied. But these two were still left intact. Which, by the way, the book of Jeremiah talks in terms about the tombs in the Valley of Hinnom being plundered, the bones taken out and scattered around on the surface as contempt for their defiance of Israel, or their defiance of Yahweh. But in the excavation of this repository, they found a couple of interesting items. Next. The little items, and they were tiny. The length of this item is about 3/4 of an inch long. But they recognized that these were unique. They were certainly different and demanding of some special attention. So they took them to the curators and asked them to be unrolled. And the next picture will show the photograph of the artifact on the left and the drawing on the right. It's an inscription. Now this dates from the time of Josiah, about 720 B.C. or so. And the inscription reads, next, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift His countenance upon you and give you peace." Now my question is, why was this artifact buried with someone? Was it simply a personal momentum of the individual that, you know, Susie has passed away, so let's let her have this piece of personal jewelry to take with her into the afterlife? Was it an indication of the devotion of the individual to the Lord to be carried with them into the afterlife? But still, the implicit component is a perspective of an afterlife into which then the Lord bless you and keep you. I find it really annoying that the argument is often made, as indicated at the beginning of this, that the Israelites had no understanding of an afterlife until the time of the exile and the Zoroastrians. That doesn't even make any sense in view of the Egyptians had an understanding of an afterlife. The Mesopotamians had an understanding of the afterlife. The Canaanites had an understanding of the afterlife. And all the neighbors around Israel had an understanding of the afterlife. Were the Israelites so dense as to have none until they're taken off into exile beyond the Assyrians and the Babylonians? That doesn't even make any sense. It also ignores the evidence that is embedded within Scripture of their understanding of the comforts of an afterlife. Why should I mourn? Can I bring him back? I will go to him. He shall not return to me. I know that my Redeemer lives. Jesus came to make the understanding of an afterlife in part an absolute certainty. He's raised from the dead. And He makes Himself manifest after He is risen to hosts of people, dozens of people, different settings, different circumstances, different scenarios, carries on conversations, occasionally will disappear and then appear. All of these bewildering circumstances that testify in the hearts of those individuals who take with a passion and a fervor the belief in Jesus as the Son of God, the Redeemer of humanity, who gives us the promise of life everlasting. And we will die on that. I know that my Redeemer lives. Are we willing to die for that? We live in a world today in which that question is increasingly viable, because there are a lot of people in the world who have faced exactly those kinds of questions because they're Christians. Remember the Columbine shootings? Anybody in here a Christian? Girl raises her hand. She gets shot because of that. And then there's ISIS and ISIL. Thank God there's an afterlife. Thank God there's one. And God has not left humanity without evidence. He's not asking us simply to believe on the basis of nothing. God has operated within the framework of human beings' history throughout the years. We have the evidence. We have the testimony. Are we willing to look at it fairly and honestly? Have you put on Jesus? Are you following Him faithfully? If you need to make your life what it ought to be spiritually, if you need to get on the path of service to the Lord, we encourage you to take those steps that you need to, whether it's baptism into Christ initially or a return to the Lord in dedication and devotion. If we can help you in any way, we encourage you to come while we stand and while we sing.